Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. Today, my guest is Karen DeBonis, who writes about motherhood, people-pleasing, and personal growth inspired by the experience of raising her son, Matthew. Her debut memoir, Growth, A Mother, Her Son, and the Brain Tumor They Survived, was released by Apprentice House Press in May 2023. Karen's work has appeared in the New York Times, HuffPost, Today.com, Newsweek.com, and others. A happy empty nester, Karen lives in upstate New York with her husband of 40 years. You can see more of her work at KarenDeBonis.com. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you, Ronit. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm so happy that you're here. And this has been in the works for a while.
Right.
It feels like a really long time ago that we initially connected about mm-hmm. your being a guest. And it's finally here. And I'm so happy that we have the chance to talk about your memoir. And for those who have not yet read it or are mm-hmm. new to your work, can you share a bit about the memoir, your memoir, Growth?
Sure. At its core, it's really about the challenge of finding and using my voice, fighting my lifelong people-pleasing, and the struggle really peaked during the time when my son Matthew was deteriorating. We didn't know what was going on, but he was having odd symptoms and kind of regressing in terms of maturity and schoolwork and that type of thing. And we later found out that all that was due to a brain tumor that went mm-hmm. undiagnosed for 3 years. And part of the story also is the medical gaslighting that happened mm-hmm. mostly with our pediatrician. And medical gaslighting is when a healthcare provider dismisses a patient's concerns. Often it's a mother's concerns about her child. So that's a big part of the story. And, you know, when I step back and look at the whole story, which the main part of it was when Matthew was struggling with this brain tumor, both the undiagnosed part of it and then recovering from it. But to me, it's really about surviving motherhood, because I wasn't prepared for this hand that I was dealt. You know, I was second oldest of six children, oldest daughter. My parents were wonderful role models. I knew motherhood was going to be tough, but mm-hmm. I didn't expect what I got. So, you know, it was a long haul, and I really think of it about surviving. And so mm-hmm. the title comes from the growth that I went through as a woman and as a mother during this difficult time.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. And I'm so glad you brought up the medical gaslighting, because reading your book, I didn't realize that that was going to be an element. And as mm-hmm. the pages went on and these interactions, especially with the pediatrician, you depicted them in such clarity. And I thought, oh my goodness, this pediatrician doubts that Karen is seeing what she's seeing and is mm-hmm. doubting whether or not her instincts are right. And I saw that happening on the page before you, as the character Karen, right. realized it. And
right.
it's really hard to witness mm-hmm. in a craft, you know, craft-wise, and the way that you did it is great. Mm-hmm. But
thank
as a
you.
Mom, as a person, as a reader, I just felt awful for what you were going through, on top of, and we'll talk about this in a little while, mm-hmm. the binge eating and the depression right. and the postpartum mm-hmm. and just this feeling moms and probably dads get too, where, but very strong in moms, where you just expect one set of outcomes. And when it's not happening, mm-hmm. you can really, really beat yourself up.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's interesting about the medical gaslighting. So my book came out in May, and I had heard of that term, medical gaslighting, you know, kind of, I would say, in the 6 months or so before my book came out. And I guess I just wasn't putting two and two together, because that particular term did not make it to the book.
Right.
But it's kind of like, as soon as the book came out and I was just in the reading that I was doing and, you know, keeping up with things, this term started coming up more and more, and I was reading essays about it, and I thought, wow, I mean, that's exactly what was happening. And I have to say, in some ways, I'm glad that I didn't kind of position the book as a book about medical gaslighting, because I think what may have happened is that would have been kind of the focus of a reader that, oh, this doctor did this terrible thing. And, you know, by not listening to this parent who was so distraught. And yet the purpose of my whole book is really to hold myself accountable. What part did I have in this dynamic where my son was just, you know, his needs were going unmet? What was my part in this? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in retrospect, I'm glad that it kind of happened the way it is. I can talk about it now and say, yes, this thing happened, medical gaslighting. But the other side of the coin is I was a people pleaser and I did not do my part to speak up for my son, not loudly enough and soon enough. So that it's really that intersection of those two, which is just, boy, a disaster waiting to happen.
It's interesting because I hear what you're saying. And so this makes me excited talking about it on a memoir level, because you're right. I think what you're saying, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that had you used that term, you could have used it more as a crutch and the book would have been wrapped up in this way or marketed in this way. Mm-hmm. And it might have been more of a finger pointing type of exercise and a little more pat. Whereas what I see in your book is a lot of opportunities for you to show how you didn't believe that you had a right to do more, that you had to make people happy. And you talk about the origins of that and how it exists everywhere in your life. Right. And so the growth, of course, has a lot of meanings. And the growth is your growth as a parent, as a woman, as a wife, as a mom, and your understanding about your empowerment and what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's important to note, this is just a side note, that when you come from a pretty conventional or average set of circumstances as a kid with parents who seem like they just do everything fine and great, it can be really hard to experience difficulties with your own child.
Yeah, that's true. That's a great point. And, you know, I think that's one way that my story of people pleasing maybe differs from what is typical or what people expect. You know, we hear often about not just women, but men, you know, but children who are raised in really dysfunctional homes with like multi-stressed families. And they learn people pleasing because it protects them. It keeps, you know, mommy and daddy happy, so there's less yelling and screaming and whatever else is going on. And so it's that learned behavior, which was really, you know, a survival skill at that time. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was a learned behavior, but it's because both my parents were people pleasing and I had no role models to learn how to deal with conflict. Now, I do have to say, I'm one of six kids, and my siblings all somehow figured out to be assertive, how to be assertive. And in fact, I have one sister, she's about 4 years younger than me, and she's one of the most assertive women I've ever known. And so, you know, I have to look at, well, then how did this happen? And I think part of it was birth order. Part of it was, you know, that I liked having some responsibility for my siblings, you know, caring for them, at least the younger ones and that type of thing. And it's partly just how I'm wired. I'm not wired to be comfortable with conflict, to be comfortable with anger. So again, it's this intersection of all these different factors.
Yes, but that's why it's your memoir too.
Yeah.
Because another writer might have approach the material differently. Mm-hmm. Another person, another mom, another woman might not have this pattern. And that's the thing. That's why all of our stories are worthy of being turned into a memoir if what we're doing is seeking the pattern and the way that we are in the world and what we're trying to understand. I mean, that's why it's not just, oh, this is a memoir of a mom who dealt with her child's tumor. That's not only what your book is about. It's about, you know, you, Karen. And I think also it's a really good point what you said about how you didn't come to the medical gaslighting term until later. But it's really an example of how, had you had different marketing, or let's say a publishing house that was found by an agent that then decided that this was it, you know, we're hooking we're hooking into this, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
How different the book would have been. And it's not whether what's right or wrong, good or bad. It's just it, your book and your writing of it and the journey of getting it into the world is so conditional. Like, there's so many different things that go into it that create the work at the end, right? So how did you approach writing the material? How did you approach, you know, discovering the structure for the book? How did you accumulate pages? And how did you know, ah, this is the way I want it to be?
Right. Well, so I started writing in around 1999. My son Matthew was diagnosed in 1997. And I think I may have mentioned this. I was not a writer. I have a, you know, a graduate degree, college degree, but you know, I just didn't do creative writing. I wrote reports and, you know, research papers and that type of thing. And it's kind of cliche, but my friends, when they heard a little more of what went on behind the story, because I didn't talk about it much when we were going through it. And that's another whole angle of the story. But, you know, friends would say to me, oh, you should write a book. And I'm like, yeah, right. You know, I haven't written anything. And the more I thought about it, I thought, and I knew from the beginning, this was about my people pleasing. And I thought, I need to tell this story because I see that behavior in other women. And I thought, boy, I wish I had known more when I was younger or a young mother. You know, I might have really been helped in this whole struggle. So I started taking classes. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I was advised early on that memoir should not be strictly chronological, but that's how I went about writing it because I just didn't know any other way. And so I got to the point a number of years ago, well, I wrote for a number of years and then I ended up leaving my full-time job because I didn't think Matthew would graduate from high school unless I was really, this was after his surgery and some treatment, unless I was really there for him full-time. So I put the memoir aside for probably 10 years and then about 7 years ago went back to it. And at that point, I thought, okay, I was aware that I needed like an entry point into the story. And I couldn't just start with, Matthew was born on August 13th, you know, 1986. And there's this concept in medias res. I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's picking a point that's in the middle of the narrative. So I picked this point where Matthew, it was really his first symptom. He started having eye rolling. And once I pick that as the entry point to the story, then I could go, you know, I could tell a little bit more of the story and then go back and give some backstory, a little bit about my parents, and then kind of pick up with the chronology. And then a couple times I step out of that chronological telling and explore what's going on with me and a little bit more about my past. So it was a lot of trial and error to get what felt right. You know, it's just, it's not just a, you know, snap your fingers and it happens.
And did you find that there were any aspects of the story that were especially challenging to calibrate when it came to looking at your behavior and the specialists you saw for Matthew? I'm curious where you might have found the need to push yourself and where you might have figured out, oh, I can pull back here. I've done that enough already. Can you kind of talk about that?
Yeah. Well, there were, I would say, a couple situations that I really had to decide, you know, do I want this to be part of the story? One was my postpartum depression. And then, so that was kind of a situation that went on for, I don't know, maybe 6 months, and it wasn't well recognized in 1986, and it went undiagnosed, and I just kind of struggled through it, and by some miracle, you know, we got through it. Here we are. And then there was another, just a particular scene that happened when Matthew was in fifth grade, so it was about a year before he was diagnosed, when by that point, I just felt so alone in the struggle to try to figure out what was wrong with my son and so exhausted by his just exasperating behaviors. And one night, I lost it. And I knew that I could pummel my child. Like I knew I was right on that edge, and I was very close to physically abusing him. And boy, both of those times, you know, it was really tough to decide, are these pieces that need to be in there? Mm-hmm. But I knew, you know, I made a commitment to telling the story as honestly as I could. And I just, if I was writing this story so other mothers would feel heard, I needed to write them because I know other mothers, you know. So I tell about with my postpartum depression, holding my screaming, colicky baby in this rocking chair and having visions of tossing him out the window. Mm-hmm. And I know other mothers have sat in that rocking chair with me. I knew as they were reading my story, they were there with me. And so I needed to tell it to say, hey, me too. You know, me
yeah,
too.
It definitely takes courage. Did you have any reactions to those sections from early readers or readers now that had an effect on you?
I have not, Roni. And this is the weird thing. I really thought one of my greatest fears in putting this book out there, I thought I was going to be excoriated for being a bad mom. And I have gotten almost nothing but support. So it's just been kind of a surprising, but just so uplifting, you know, such an uplifting experience.
Right. I do think we get telling our stories as truthfully as we know how or as we can, and really not flinching as much when we get into the parts that we are so afraid of revealing does have this, I hate to use the word payoff, but it really does. It does have this ripple effect where our writing is enriched and then the readers feel that they know us better and our book as a whole becomes more than just this story we wrote.
Right. And if my goal is to help other women who are struggling with either difficult motherhoods or, you know, children with disabilities or you know, behavioral problems or people pleasing, it's not going to work. It's a waste of my time if I'm not honest. So I really decided to do that. And in terms of the specialists, you know, again, my goal in this was not to blame anyone. There are no villains in the story, although I have heard from readers that they kind of feel that the pediatrician might have filled that role. But, you know,
I might have felt that way, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I understand that. But, you know, I feel like all the adults in Matthew's life could have done better. We were all imperfect human beings who made mistakes, but none of us were villains. There was one doctor who was kind of borderline, I don't know, unstable perhaps. But for the most part, you know, everybody was, they were doing their best, and that included mistakes. And so with the specialist, I really wanted to just write what happened and how that affected me, but then let the reader come to their own conclusion about how they feel about that doctor or that specialist.
Which I really appreciated. Did Matthew read your book? And does he remember that one incident that you talk about where you were more physical with him?
Fortunately, he does not remember.
I know. Yeah. That's like a blessing, right? Because I feel the same way.
And, you know, in many ways, not just that particular situation, but Matthew really struggled with memory and short-term memory specifically. And there were many times throughout the whole story where that was actually a blessing because I think if he was more, I mean, he was aware what was going on, but I think if he remembered more details, it might have been much, much worse. So in terms of him reading it, he has not. A few years ago, when I got the manuscript to the point where I really felt that I was ready to share it with my two sons and my husband. My husband kind of had was more aware of what I was writing. There were times, again, I just didn't share with him for a gazillion different reasons. And so as I was finishing the manuscript, I would say, dear, can we sit on the couch and talk? And I would have him read, you know, a couple pages or something. And that was really difficult for him to know what I had gone through and that he didn't know. And perhaps sometimes, you know, closed his eyes to what he could have known. Mm-hmm. With both my sons, I let them know about some of the really, really difficult scenes. I talked it through with them before I just handed them this manuscript. I wanted them to, you know, to hear it from me. That was very, very hard. Mm-hmm. And Matthew, he gave back the manuscript after, I don't know, it might have been a couple months. I followed up with him, and he said, I can't read it. It's too painful. Brings back too many painful memories. And I completely respect that. And at the same time, he's been extremely supportive of all of this. I told him, you know, many years ago, I said, when he knew I was writing this memoir, I said, look, you get the right of first, or you get veto, right? So if there's something in there you don't want in there, then it won't go in there. And he was okay with all of it, which... Mm-hmm. I think takes tremendous courage on his part. Mm-hmm. But there's a part of him, he wanted the story out there, even though it was hard, even though he hasn't read the book. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just going to leave it there. And there may be a time in the future, he's 37 now, there may be a time in the future that he's ready to read it. But right now, that's not the time.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to read that excerpt we talked about?
Yep, I would love to do that. So I'll just set it up a little bit. So after that incident where I really thought I was going to beat Matthew to a pulp, I just had this wake-up call. Like, this is not the mom I want to be. This is not the relationship I want with my child. So I called the pediatrician the next day. I said I want a referral for counseling, and I got us into counseling. So Adam is the counselor. He's a child psychologist. And before, at one point in the, we had been seeing him for a few months, and he thought that the diagnosis with it was ADD, attention deficit disorder, which is essentially ADHD without the hyperactivity. And it was a perfect fit. It made total sense at the time. Mm-hmm. Except then Matthew wasn't getting better with all the behavioral programs we put in place, and we even tried a trial of Ritalin. So then at one point, Matt was just continuing to deteriorate, and he had this track meet that just went horribly, and we had this middle school orientation that just went terribly. We ended up deciding to send him to a private school, LaSalle. In the meantime, all these tests are coming back negative, and, you know, it was just really a really difficult spot to be in. So here's the scene when I'm at an appointment with Adam. At our next appointment with Adam, Matthew needed my prodding to remember the track meet in middle school orientation. After sending Matthew to the waiting room, Adam listened as I waxed and waned about the negative blood test, the special ed evaluation, and LaSalle. I shrugged. Dr. Peterson, that's the pediatrician, Dr. Peterson still believes what's going on is no big deal. Adam listened, his elbows resting on the arms of his chair, his hands folded in front of his face. Holding my gaze, he rubbed his forehead. Karen, something more than ADD is going on with Matthew. I shifted uncomfortably in my seat. Adam leaned forward to continue, his tone intense. I don't know what's happening in his body, but something isn't right. He paused as I reached for the box of tissues. I'll go to bat for you, Karen. I've given Dr. Peterson my assessment, but I can't do it alone. You're Matthew's mom. You're going to have to fight for answers. For a therapist to give advice is unusual. Therapy is meant to empower clients to make their own decisions as part of the personal growth process. A therapist who gives advice risks robbing his client of crucial insight and learning. When a client's safety is at risk, a therapist may try to help her arrive at a safe course of action. If the client's denial is immutable and their blinders occlusive, however, a therapist may have no choice but to advise. Call a domestic abuse hotline and don't go home. Or, your risk-taking is endangering your life, or, in my case, you have to fight for your child. I wondered how long Adam had been guiding me toward the need to battle, hoping I'd hear a wake-up revelry. Maybe he had dropped breadcrumbs for weeks or months, but I hadn't seen them through my fog of self-doubt. Sitting back, Adam watched for a moment as I dabbed my eyes. Then he leaned forward again as if to say something. He rubbed the back of his neck, opened his mouth, then closed it. When he looked at me, he saw right through my defenses. "No one else will do it for you, Karen." Clearly, Adam had figured out that I wasn't a fighter, that I preferred to have someone else, meaning my husband Mike, do the dirty work. But Adam had also discerned that my husband would not carry the torch. When I left to gather my wits and retrieve Matthew, internally I puffed out my chest, determined to heed Adam's call to action. "Ready, Matthew?" His fingers paused on his Game Boy, and he looked up at me with trust in his eyes. My chest deflated. I had betrayed Matthew's trust by not listening to what I knew in my heart all along. His deterioration was not normal. The next day, I called Dr. Peterson and asked for referrals to an occupational therapist and physical therapist, a route my colleagues had suggested. "Insurance won't cover it," Dr. Peter replied. "I'll pay for it myself," I thought. Then I asked for a referral to a neurologist, and she finally relented. "I think you need this for your peace of mind." In other words, Matthew's symptoms weren't the problem, I was.
Thank you. You know, I have to say, the whole Munchausen by proxy, I did start to get that sense before you addressed it in the book. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it's so infuriating to mm-hmm. read. I know you're not trying to infuriate your reader. I'm more trying to let you know that it's very clear what's happening, mm-hmm. that she believes you're the problem. Mm-hmm. And you ultimately, you find your way out of this. Of course, your son is 37 now. I'm curious what it's like for you even now to think that she thought that you perhaps were experiencing Munchausen by proxy. And, mm-hmm. you know, what your interactions with Dr. Peterson showed you about Matthew's medical trajectory and yourself.
Mm-hmm. So Munchausen syndrome by proxy, for people that don't know, it's a mental health disorder and also considered child abuse, when an adult fakes or creates an illness in a child to gain attention for themselves. And our pediatrician, who we had had since Matthew was born, and we, you know, trusted her at least until the year or so before this, she suspected that I had Munchausen syndrome by proxy. In other words, that I was intentionally harming my son. And I mean, it was just, and I found that out when I got her doctor's notes and saw mm-hmm. that she had called the psychologist, and it was just soul crushing. But mm-hmm. also because I knew that I didn't do that. So just mm-hmm. the rage that filled me, I mean, it was just like blinding. And we were fortunate in a way that it was very shortly after that Matthew, everything kind of escalated, and Matthew ended up getting an MRI, which found the brain tumor, because then it clearly showed, you know, I wasn't the one doing it. And my husband and I, you know, when I was writing about this whole thing, this was another struggle in how to write this, because, oh, readers are going to hate my husband now, but he and I do. I mean, that's, you know, we've talked about this. He and I have talked about this, and I talk about this in my book. You know, he was not accused, so he didn't feel it like I did. He did not feel betrayed. He felt like the doctor was doing her job. And I went back and forth and back and forth. In this particular section, I had a lot of editorial help in writing it. And I have wonderful critique partners and submitted chapters for editing and that type of thing. And I really went back and forth about what is my truth for this. And I won't go into details because I think it's really a part of the book that really works best in context of the whole book. But I did come to a place, it's even hard for me to say this, Ronit, it was very hard for me to write this in the book. I came to a place where even with this, I do not feel that she was a villain. She had been a good doctor to us for many years, and she screwed up royally. And it could have been, fatal, because her suspicions were confirmed and there was some investigation, you know what would have happened? Everything would have been blamed on me, and poor Matthew would have continued to deteriorate, and he very well may have died. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's horrifying to think about what happened. But like I said, just with the timing of it, it was resolved before. And thank goodness for the child psychologist who said, no way, this is not a mother who would do this. You know,
right. So and also, I mean, you ultimately need the evidence that other people come to you with about how he has declined, how Matthew has declined.
Exactly.
And instead of, it's interesting because instead of being angry when someone says to you, he has really deteriorated, he's so different than he used to be, you grab at it because it's evidence that you're not mad.
Exactly. It's validation. It's like, okay, what I'm seeing is real.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So later in the book, it's about on page 290, you write, quote, if I'd held a sign fresh from the womb, it would have read, and this is about you, fragile, handle with care. By nature and nurture, I wasn't a fighter. Fierceness wasn't in my DNA. When someone like me takes a stand, it is a story meant to be told, a tale of many lessons. My fragile sign had been a means of self-preservation for many years, but it came to feel like a flag. And then when you're in a hospital scene, and you find that this is a tumor causing Matthew's decline, you then describe this she-bear you find within you, and you write, I imagined a new sign, one that felt authentic, that honored who I'd been and who I'd evolved to be. It was the message she-bear had conveyed, and this is all in caps, when the weak show strength, they are stronger than the strong. And so I'm curious, after all these years, where you are now in your fragile versus she-bear journey.
Well, I got to tell you, Ronit, I am not the same person I was before. And, you know, I'll just reiterate. So my she-bear looks very differently, maybe from other women's, you know, kind of warrior mom stance or their ability to speak truth to power and that type of thing. You know, my she-bear is still kind of polite and sometimes soft-spoken and sometimes hesitant. But I do speak up. And it's you know, it's little baby steps, but I'll give you one example that was actually not insignificant. So during the height of COVID, my husband and I were very, very careful about masking and social distancing. He has type 1 diabetes, so he was really worried, and I didn't want to get COVID and then pass it on to him. And there was actually a time, one of the first times I had a doctor's appointment, and the doctor kept taking her mask off to talk, and I didn't say anything. And I was driving home thinking, oh my, like I was so disappointed at myself. And I thought, how could I put my husband at risk? Because I couldn't just say, please put a mask on. And I just decided I'm not. And this was after the book was, I don't think I had a contract at that point, but the book was very much written. And, you know, I went back like a few days later. It was actually physical therapy, so I was going a couple times a week. And I just, in the nicest voice, said to the doctor, oh, would you mind just putting your mask back on? She said, oh, yes, of course. I'm sorry. And I thought, that's what I was fearing all this time. And it was so easy. So, and there have been many times, you know, I don't mask anymore, but there have been many times through that whole COVID few years that I asked doctors to put a mask on, and it was always a little bit uncomfortable, but you know, it just wasn't a big deal. So that part of me, there are things that happen where I am just so, you know, I'm proud of myself that I did the work, and you know, I'm overcoming this kind of paralyzing people pleasing that I've had.
Yeah. And I'm curious if close relatives who grew up in sort of the same environment noticed the change in you and if they have thoughts about it.
Oh, good question. My siblings are all over the country, so we don't get together enough that they would notice it. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is it's more my friends and my, you know, kind of my writing friends and people who know that this people pleasing is part of my, has been part of my journey and part of my book. And they will say things to me, like if I, let's say I post something on Facebook and they'll say, oh, that people pleaser is gone, isn't she? You know, so they will pick up on it.
Yeah, which, they're like applauding
yes,
that, right?
Yes, and it's great support. And yeah. I just have to say one more thing about this whole, you know, this like social media and this whole journey. That one of the things that turned this whole people pleasing thing around for me the most was outing myself. So I do it in the book, and I started doing it on mostly on Facebook, and I hated it. I hated to say things like, oh, I came home with the grocery bag today, and once again, the bagger put the tomato at the bottom, and I didn't have the nerve to ask him to move it. Like, I hate it. It was so humiliating. Like, I'm a grown woman. What's wrong with me? But, you know, I just felt like the only way that I will be able to confront this is if I confront it to myself. And mm-hmm. so I feel that just continuing to out myself, this is the struggle. This is how bad it is, how hard this is. That's what has enabled me to change.
Mm-hmm. And to share it, right? That vulnerability.
Yeah, right, right.
So in the same vein as vulnerability, I mean, this is really vulnerable.
Yeah.
You recently had a book event for growth and posted a photo of yourself at the reading because, and I want you to talk about this, but the reason we're talking about this is because that went viral. Mm-hmm. And I would love you to share a bit about what happened and what you make of the response people had to your sharing that experience.
Yeah, I'm still trying to wrap my brain around it. So, let's see, a little over a week ago, I had a book talk at a local library, and it was a no-show. Nobody came. And, you know, the library did some promotion. I did not as much as I wish I would have done, but nobody came.
Wait. Hold on.
Oh,
I have to ask.
Yeah.
15, 20 people had come. Mm-hmm. Would you have thought, oh, I did enough promotion? Or did you know going in, oh, I'm not doing enough promotion?
I knew. Because I had, long story, I had COVID in September and things got backed up. Like I had to reschedule things and then I had a cold that lasted and I got behind in everything. So I knew that I didn't promote it as much as I normally would for other book talks. Mm-hmm. Not that I get big crowds, like five people is my average, but I'm perfectly mm-hmm. fine with that. So there's this room, they had all these chairs set up in this room, 20 chairs or something, and you know, I said to my husband, take a picture of me. You know, I'm sitting on the chair kind of facing toward the back of the room. And he said, why would you want to do this? And I just thought, it's part of the journey. You know, like I was disappointed, but I wasn't humiliated. I wasn't beaten down. I was a little bit amused. It's like, you know, Stephen King writes about having no shows. So it's like, here I am. And I posted on Facebook and Twitter. And on Twitter, it went viral. It's up to 1.2 million views.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
But the really like mind-blowing thing is people were saying things like you were so courageous to share this vulnerability and I'm so inspired. I'm going to buy your book. And then they bought my book. I don't actually get sales reports from my publisher. That's another story, but then a couple of days later they would post pictures of my book in their hands. So I know that they bought it. So flattering and such a beautiful thing, Roni. Like you know, social media can just be such a brutal and negative place. And here, there was absolutely no trolling, no bots, no negativity. It was all positive. And I just thought, wow. And it was so validating for my memoir because in my memoir, I get really vulnerable. And that's mm-hmm. my purpose. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's how I'm going to connect with people. So then this thing happened on Twitter. And it's like, wow, vulnerability really resonates with people. That's mm-hmm. where we connect. So, yeah, just this exciting, bizarre growth, you know, thing that happened.
Yeah, I'm so happy that we had the chance to talk about this. I mean, yeah. I'm sorry that no one came to your event.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Yes, vulnerability. So you've been giving advice throughout, you know, inadvertently and mm-hmm. also pointedly advice during our conversation. But yep. as we wind up our time together, is there advice you'd like to share with writers working on their memoirs?
Yeah, a couple things. You know, one is in terms of craft, just be a sponge, especially if you're just starting out. You know, be a sponge, learn everything you can, just, you know, kind of take it all in, and you'll sort out later what works for you and what doesn't work for you. But just be a sponge. I highly recommend finding a critique group. I know it's not that easy. I really lucked out, but
you did luck out. I know, it's
just an awesome group. And, you know, I would say for memoirists, if you can at all find a critique group of other memoirists, that is going to be a better place for you than kind of, you know, fiction writers or general writers, just you know, Ronit, writing a memoir, it's a different experience, you know, when you're just putting your soul out there.
We are our own thing, for sure, memoirists.
Yeah. And in terms of just the kind of inevitable emotional trauma of writing a memoir, you know, get support. I got myself into counseling, and, you know, I know other writers have done that too. Even if counseling isn't your thing, just make sure you get support somewhere, because it's, you know, it's a tough journey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And are there memoirs that you like to recommend, or any kind of book that has helped you as you wrote yours?
Yeah, well, you know, I got together a stack of about 10 or 12, and I thought, well, let me pick out three that really were kind of informed me in my own journey. One of them is Raising a Rare Girl, a memoir by Heather Lanier.
And she was a guest, yes.
Oh, she was. Okay. Yeah. Not only is it one of the most beautiful memoirs I've read, in my opinion, but, you know, she really goes into what it's like to not have the perfect child that you kind of think you're going to have as a mom. So I just, that book just really spoke to me a lot. And one of the first books in recent years, I would say, that really spoke to me. And by the way, I'm, you know, these are kind of by lesser known authors, and I do that intentionally. I just think any chance I have to support, you know, a lesser known author who worked just as hard on their book as, you know, maybe Prince Harry, I think it's a good thing. So Judith Hannon wrote a book, Motherhood Exaggerated. And I love this book because I feel like she really captured this whole motherhood experience. What happens when you have a sick child, but just this whole exaggerated thing. Like, it's just, it's not kind of the typical motherhood experience. So that's a great one. And then the last one was kind of a unusual find, I guess. Janine Urbaniak-Reed wrote a book, The Opposite of Certainty. And her son had the exact same brain tumor as my son. And her son ultimately did not survive. So, you know, just I could relate so much to what she went through, and knowing that he did not survive, as many, you know, patients with brain tumors do not, you know, just reminds me every day how blessed I am every single day that our story has a happy ending.
Yeah, it's very tough. Very, very tough. Yeah. Thank you for those. Karen, I think at the beginning of the interview, I mentioned that the listeners can find you at KarenDeBonis.com.
Yep.
Where are you on social media?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. And, well, I was going to drop out of X, but after that beautiful experience, I'm recommitting to that. So, and I'm pretty much, all my handles are similar, at Karen DeBonis, you know, something or other. I have an Instagram page. I don't do a lot on it. I have a LinkedIn page. I don't do a lot. I'm still trying to figure out how to manage all this social media stuff. But if you forget, I have all my links, and also, you know, purchase links on my website, www.karendebonis.com. So everything's there.
Great. I will put all those in the show notes along with the memoirs you recommended. And
I want to thank you very much for sharing your story and your reflections on this whole process of living through this medical conundrum and having your son and you come out so strong afterward. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. This was a really enjoyable conversation. I really enjoyed this, and I so appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RonitPlank. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have 2 more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.